So, in Scotland, as I said, there are lambs. We'll keep the lights off. Thank you. Then it's easier to see the pictures. They mark the lambs, the mothers and the children, so that they can keep the families together. Or if there's a illness, then they're also marked. There are lambs everywhere, and there's also cows, hairy cows, Scottish cows, which are, you know, you're in a different country when you see these cows. But I always return to the lambs. There's something, as we were driving along the road, and it was a bit stressful, Theo was driving, say no more. He would, in order to relieve some of my stress, he would point out the window, lambs! Because he knew that would settle my heart. So, Scotland, this is not a travel sermon. I want to focus on one or two specific things of the journey, especially in the last week that I was there. For the first 2 weeks, I was in a small town called Pitlochry, which is in the very center of the country, and pretty well everywhere else is about 2 hours from Pitlochry. So we started our last week by driving across Pitlochry, across Scotland towards Oban, and we took a ferry to the island of Mull. And that was another driving experience because we experienced single carriage tracks for the first time. And this means it's a tiny little road with stone walls or cliffs or mountains on either side, only enough space for one small car to travel. Luckily, every 150, 200 feet, there's a small little turnoff. So the cars come barreling towards each other, and as soon as you see one in the distance, you look for one of these laybys, and you tuck in, and the other car goes swooping past you. And it's met with always, except where one probably freaked out tourist, everybody waves at you and thanks you for stopping. We were going to the island of Iona. Iona is very famous. It is a place of pilgrimage for many people. There has been a Christian monastery there for hundreds of years. This is where St. Columba came from Ireland and established the monastery there, and then later there was a nunnery established. This is the monastery seen from the water. It is a place of deep peace. If you know the writing, the Celtic prayer, deep peace of the running waves to you. This is an island that has drawn people for hundreds of years to experience this indescribable deep peace. Indescribable for me. You have to experience it. It also has a very famous graveyard where in the 17th century, well, back from the 1549, there was an inventory taken of 48 Scottish kings buried there, 8 Norwegian kings, and 4 Irish kings. None of the graves are discernible anymore, so it's only historical accounts that tell us who is actually buried there, but you might know the name of Macbeth, who is one of the kings. We know him through Shakespeare, if you went through grade 12 English, grade 11 English. The actual body of Macbeth, the king of Scotland, is buried there. So the United Kingdom is created, and I'm not going to assume everybody knows this. The United Kingdom is created by 4 countries. There's Northern Ireland, Wales, England, and Scotland. And if we go to the next one, you'll see excluding the white part, which is the Republic of Ireland. The yellow is Northern Ireland, a country unto itself. Scotland, a country unto itself, in the blue. Green is Wales, and red is England. So after Iona, we did a crazy thing. We headed north. So on your left is a map of Scotland. And at the very top, so I'm going to just come over here so you can see, for those that don't know, I'm sorry if I'm screwing up the sound here. So this is Iona, this is Mull, and this is a tiny little island connected to it of Iona. So we went from there all the way up to what you see as red. And what you see there are the Hebrides, the Orkney Islands. There's a collection of islands that if you were up there and you stood north, to the northeast is Iceland, and to the northwest, I'm sorry, I'm all mixed up here, from northwest is Iceland and northeast is Norway. That's how high up it is. There is an oft-quoted saying that if you scratch the soil in Orkney, it bleeds archaeology. There are Neolithic villages, Iron Age encampments, and cairns, which are tombs, that it seems they're in every farmer's field. Many of these places of our shared ancestors have been lost by the sea's erosion, or by a frustrated farmer who just wanted to flatten his field. Humankind first set foot on the land now called Scotland about 9,000 years ago. For the first 3,000 years, our Mesolithic ancestors were hunters and gatherers. Slowly, they began to choose to settle in one area. Their primitive stone tools evolved into ones capable of taming their environment and tilling the soil. By 4,000 BC, so that's 6,000 years from now, our Stone Age ancestors became the first farmers and built permanent homes, ceremonial places, and burial tombs that, because they were made from stone, are preserved today. This is before the Great Pyramids were built, before the famous Stonehenge of southern England was erected, before the Picts and the Vikings, and 4,000 years before Bonnie Prince Charlie and the wars with the English. There existed a Neolithic people who lived peacefully in family communities in the northern collection of islands of Scotland called the Orkneys. The Neolithic village on the east coast of the mainland of Orkney is called Broch of Gurness. From the late Iron Age, the Pictish living home from 500 BC to 200 BC is found at the village of Gurness. It's the best preserved of all the Broch villages. It's built on the edge of the sea. You can see in that last picture, if we could go back to, you can see it's right on the edge of the sea there. An easy distance from the next island, you can see. This is the entranceway that leads north past some of the houses you can see on either side, towards the main structure, or broch, which is tower. And it was likely about 10 meters tall before it was ravaged by the sands of time. And it would have probably held the leader of the community and their family. And probably there would be a community space there where decisions for the community would be made, or maybe even religious rituals. There are numerous houses that surround the center of the Bruch. The entrance of each leads to a large living or sleeping room area, off which there are smaller rooms. So where the stone is there, you can see is the center of that particular living room. Each main room had a hearth, which you can see there, a large tank set into the floor, cupboards, the tank would be for water, cupboards and sleeping spaces, which are delineated by stone. Some of the houses had a yard connected to them, which would be open to the sky, and also a shed for storage. That gives you a better idea of how clear the spaces were. The guide that morning had our undivided attention for about 45 minutes, as there was no one else there, and enthusiastically shared the history of the people who had lived there at Gurness, which included the later Vikings who settled in the Orkneys around 800 AD, and who used the ancient settlement mounds as burial places for their own people. And here the stone lined, and in this, I don't have a picture of it, but at Gurness, there was an area just outside where the living area was, which was a stone-lined grave of a Viking woman. And she was found with a sickle and blade made from iron and a pair of tortoise brooches made with bronze, which gives you an idea of what's important. But we don't know anything about her, except they honored her with a stone-lined grave. The guide at Gurness also told us that there was a very strong connection between the Orkneys and Canada in more recent times. He said that the Hudson's Bay Company came to the Orkneys looking for men who were brave enough and strong enough for the harsh Canadian climate to go into Canada's untouched wilderness by Europeans and set up the Hudson's Bay Company. So the Orkney people feel a real historical bond with Canada. It's a harsh environment. The wind, kind of like the prairies here, never stops. And it doesn't come through in any of the pictures, and it's hard to describe. But if you, from morning till night, day after day, have felt that power of the wind, and it's cold. It was cold even into April. People were wearing their winter clothes. So now, from the east coast of the Orkney mainland towards the center and the west is a Neolithic village called Scarabray. Scarabray was revealed in 1850. Again, it was nothing more than a mound. When a particularly ferocious storm battered the Orkneys, the combination of wind and extreme high tides stripped the grass from the top of this particular mound, known now as Scarabray. And this revealed the outline of a number of stone buildings that until 1868, the local laird, William Watt of Scale, excavated, uncovering the remains of four ancient homes. After this, further work was abandoned and the site remained undisturbed until 1925, when a further storm damaged the remains. So the rest of the excavations occurred between 25 and 1930. And then the site is now the same as it was back then. Originally, the village was thought to date from around 500 BC during the Iron Age, but radiocarbon dating during the early 1970s, it was confirmed that it was late Neolithic and that it was inhabited for about 600 years between 3,200 BC and 22,000 BC, 2200 BC. The site survives as 10 dwellings linked together by a series of low covered passageways. Each house has the same design. This is a replica, a real life, real sized replica of what each house looked like. A large square room with a central fireplace, a bed on either side, and shelved dresser on the wall opposite the doorway. And they were not sunk into the ground, but built into mounds of pre-existing rubbish that provided some stability to the dwellings, but more importantly, acted as a layer of insulation to counter the severities of the Orkney climate. Roof, you can see, the material has not survived because it was made probably of organic material, like turf, or they suggest skins, perhaps thatch straw or seaweed. Access to the houses is gained through the small doorway, which would have been blocked by a slab of stone and possibly barred as well. This shows that security was important to the dwellers, but that privacy for the family unit was also very important. The layout of Scarabray, whilst being very much geared towards a community settlement, makes this type of privacy possible. I was really struck by the fact that in all their excavations of this community, you have to think these people living so many thousands of years ago, that we have so many expectations of their unsophisticatedness and lack of knowledge. What they discovered, or what I should say, what they did not discover, was any weapons. These were peaceful people living in intentional, peaceful communities for 600 years. It was probably quite comfortable there. The weather was less harsh than it is today, so they were able to raise cattle and sheep and probably barley and wheat. I've put up some pictures of some of the things that they don't know what these were used for. They're not tools. They might be objects of art, but they, I think, indicate, and my imagination is not sophisticated or learned enough to know, that they had something to do with their theology, with their belief systems. You can see in the bottom picture, the circle that we find all over that part of the world, of the infinite circle of life, the circle that spirals in on itself, that we understand today to be an image that is a circle of life, or a depiction of the endless generation begetting generation, season after season, or perhaps an image of the universe. They also found lots of animal bones, raw materials for tools like needles and shovels and pins and knives and picks. There is no evidence of textiles, of course, because they have perished over time. There's also jewelry. They like to adorn themselves, to look beautiful, maybe to have status. I'd be quite happy to wear that necklace and bracelet today. And they don't know what this other sculpture is, but indicate that that could have been a deity. It could be one of the very first images of a god. And I wonder what the family might look like. And an artist has created this image. And to me, this was a revelation that these are people that are not so different from me, from us. Families, people that had to work through their problems just like we have to work through our problems, who came together to share, to survive together. I think of, we have our board meetings and our community meetings. They had community meetings. You know, I don't know what language they spoke, but they probably had some communication challenges, just like we have communication challenges. They lost their loved ones, just as we lose our loved ones. They honored them with burials close by, as we do with our loved ones. Close by Scarab Ray was, for me, the highlight of my journey into ancient Scotland. And it was the stones of Stenness, or Stenness, if you come from Scotland, and the Ring of Brodgar. From this statement by Historical Scotland, the stones of Stenness may be the oldest standing stones in the British Isles. The monuments at the heart of Neolithic Orkney and Scarab Ray proclaim the triumphs of the human spirit in early ages and isolated places. These stones of Stenness were approximately contemporary with the mastabes of the archaic period of Egypt, the brick temples of Sumeria, and the first cities of Harappa in India, a century or two before the Golden Age of China. Unusually fine specimens for this early date, with a remarkably rich survival of the evidence of a people that lived a sophisticated religious life long before us. That day that I visited, I think to give you a sense of height, this was a picture that Theo took from the car because it was, the rain was coming down sideways and the wind was almost impossible to walk in. I think I would have come to about here on this stone. And I got out of the car because despite the wind and the rain, I wanted to see and feel this circle or this group of standing stones, having been to Avebury and Glastonbury in southern England many years ago. And I had my head down, my raincoat. You could only see a little bit of my eyes as I walked through the wind and the rain around these stones. And I was so conscious of moving through the wind that all of a sudden, I was suddenly standing, almost bumping into this giant mass of stone. And the electricity of the shock or the power of the stone went right through me, which I will never forget. Awesome is a word I would use easily to describe these stones. The Ring of Brodgar is only about a kilometer away. These two sites are linked, and there are a number of stones that indicate that there may have been a ceremonial walkway between the two. These sites were made into World Heritage Sites in 1990 by UNESCO. The Ring of Brodgar was erected approximately 2,500 years ago. Because it is so huge, it's impossible to get a picture of the whole thing. Again, I walked up there in the wind and the rain. You can probably, just by the grayness of the picture, imagine how heavy the rain was falling. And you can see what's red there is the, help me out here, No, Heather, thank you. It is the heather that fills in the inside. They've never excavated the center of this, so they don't know what's there. I walked around the outside of it. It is a true circle, almost 104 meters wide. Although it is originally thought to have 60 of these great stones, and these stones are smaller than the ones at Stennis, they've never been able to find all the stones. There are only 27 stones remaining. So I walked around the outside of this circle because I felt that if this was a place of religion, of ritual, then, and I didn't know anything. I wasn't going to plunge into the middle of it. So I walked around, and at one point I was facing south, and I felt like there were two stones that seemed to me like an entrance. And I put my back to the circle and to these two stones and looked straight into the geography. And down in front of me were the first stones I talked about, the stones of Stennis, and then the standing stone that is halfway between the two. And that made a visual link to me between these two stones. And I imagined, what was the difference between the stones of Stennis and the Ring of Brad Gore? And I hadn't read anything about it, and I thought, it feels like one is feminine and the other is masculine. And in my reading afterwards, I've discovered that they actually call the standing stones of Stennis the moon stones and Brad Gore the sun stones. And it has something to do with how, just like in Stonehenge, they are connected to the changing seasons and the rising and the falling of the moon and the sun. I mean, we'll never really know the purpose of these stones. We can only imagine what happened in the lives of our ancestors. I have no doubt that they were the center of some sort of spiritual life for these ancestors of ours 5,000 years ago. And our spiritual knowledge, what we know today, I put to you as we cannot assume we know any more. We might know more about science. We know a lot of things that these ancestors may not have known, did not know. But when it comes to theology, to God, to ritual, to understanding the meaning of life and death, I'm not convinced that our ancestors were less sophisticated than we are. They obviously knew how to tell time and be able to anticipate the movement of the sun and the moon. They recognized the stars and the configurations of the stars and how they moved, and they made up stories about them, even as we do today. These two sites tell us that those who lived at that time regularly and predictably came together from all those small communities of 8 or 10 families. They came together to the central place where these stones are to celebrate and to honor the cycles of life and death, because we know that there's a large cairn very close by where many thousands upon thousands upon thousands of bones of these people are. And so we also know that they included and revered their ancestors, as many of us do today. From Scotland, I come back to British Columbia. It was very interesting reading about an excavation that happened here in BC while I don't know if it was while I was away or recently, and many of you may have heard about this. There was an ancient archaeological find on Triquet Island on BC's central coast, or just off BC's central coast, which added credence to the oral history of the Hiltsuk Nation. In their oral history, they have told the story of their ancestors existing from time immemorial, and that there was a time when the nations on the west coast of North America came together to avoid, to survive the last ice age. As part of this archaeological find, they have been able to carbon date to 14,000 years ago. So we've been talking about 6,000 years, 5,000 years, 14,000 years ago. The people of this part of the world, I don't know how, but came together and lived together and survived together that last ice age. And I will be speaking more about that the last service of this month, when we try to find our way through the celebration of Canada's 150th anniversary in light of people living in this part of the world for 14,000 years. Thank you. We are now going to sing together.